Cool. Well, I heard this morning from some people in Sydney that I know and trust that this conference this year has sold more tickets than any other year that we put it on. I think the last kind of, 5 or 6 years we've had this conference in Sydney. And I think that's a small but important kind of echo of something that's happening all across the world right now, which is that the experience of 21st century capitalism is stoking the revival of a mass socialist movement pretty much everywhere. And it's worth reflecting on that as well. I think that we've been told for a long time that that sort of thing is not meant to happen. So for a generation, everyone was told that we'd reached basically the end of history, that everything from here on out was going to be the peaceful spread of liberal democracy and capitalist free markets that we'd all gladly kind of accept. But what actually has happened is millions of people across the globe now are throwing themselves into serious battles, trying to figure out how to win a very different kind of society to that, one that's based on ending exploitation, ending inequality and ending oppression. So that's the kind of, I think, thing that frames the debate about socialism today. There's two important factors, I think, that are going on in politics. On the one hand, there's the revival of mass struggle that's taking place across the world, beginning with the Arab Spring several years ago and the Occupy movement, then flowing through to things like the teacher strikes in the United States, the democratic uprising in Hong Kong and the revolution in Sudan. So these are, I think, amazing and inspiring movements involving sometimes tens of thousands, sometimes millions of people throwing themselves against the state, throwing themselves against their bosses, and in many cases, in quite a few cases, winning some pretty impressive victories that are starting to cut through that sense of demoralisation, apathy that's just been ground into people for the last couple of decades. On the other hand, though, the other important thing that's going on is in the electoral sphere, which is a place that people are looking, where self-proclaimed socialists like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like Bernie Sanders, like Jeremy Corbyn, defying a lot of political common sense that said that you can't win a serious audience for your politics if you stake yourself out as to the left of the mainstream. So this is where the arguments about democratic socialism come in, basically, I think. The new socialist left that is emerging is attracted to a strategy that tries to fuse these two things together, mass struggle and electoral politics. So these strategies, people have read democratic socialists. Firstly, they claim to avoid the pitfalls of social democracy, which more and more and more blatantly over the last few decades has been drawn into just managing neoliberal capitalism rather than mounting any challenges to it. And on the other hand, it's an alternative to what is often presented as the unrealistic strategy of breaking with capitalism through a workers' revolution. So two important texts that have come out, Bashkar Sankara's Socialist Manifesto, the editor of Jacobin, and Vivek Chibba's Our Road to Power. They're both works that seek to kind of, as they put it, meld together struggles inside and outside of the capitalist state. Chibba explains his difference with revolutionary socialists like this. He says, "Our strategic perspective has to downplay the centrality of a revolutionary rupture and navigate a more gradualist path. For the foreseeable future, left strategy has to revolve around building a movement to pressure the state, gain power within it, change the institutional structure of capitalism and erode the structural power of capital rather than jumping over it." So I think democratic socialism should more accurately, in terms of how we understand it, be called parliamentary socialism or electoral socialism, because it hinges on the idea that the capitalist state and its parliament will be the main vehicle for overturning capitalism. So as kind of Chibba lays out his strategy in his essay, Our Road to Power, socialists should promote independent working class organisation while contesting elections with the goal of winning power inside the capitalist state. And such kind of successful struggles inside the capitalist state can also build protests and strikes outside the state, combined with that kind of working class organisation that can lead to successive breaks with capitalism and eventually the construction of a socialist society. Now, firstly, I want to say there are some things to agree with here. There are some positive things about the arguments of the democratic socialists. One is that they hold to a vision of a collectively organised and owned society where human need takes precedence over profit. They rightly reject the dictatorships that claimed the mantle of socialism in the 20th century and, I think, disgraced the socialist tradition, like the Soviet Union and China. And they've largely defined themselves in opposition to the sellouts of the more mainstream social democratic parties, like our Labour Party, that have, consented just to run the system as it currently exists rather than even pass any significant reforms. But the vast majority of what I'm going to talk about today is actually about what I disagree with about democratic socialism. And this can seem a little bit harsh, particularly to people who are just grappling with the debates of the socialist movement for the first time. Often it's argued, we're all pushing in the same direction, we all have the same aim, so why bother squabbling and fighting amongst ourselves? And I think the answer to that question is that while the democratic socialists have worthy aims, I think they have totally the wrong strategy to get to the kind of society that we all want to see. And the central problem with democratic socialism is that its radical ambitions are basically undermined by a strategy that's utopian. It's worth saying that the democratic socialist strategy is far from totally new. It's one that's been applied and failed countless times through history. And I think that's because it's based on an unrealistic understanding of how capitalism works, on class struggle, and on the role of the capitalist state. So that's something that I want to spend a little bit of time unpacking in this talk. So firstly, the capitalist class, everyone's heard of them, right? There's 26 people in the world that only control more wealth than the poorest, nearly 4 billion. It's not just those 26 people, though. It's the people that own all the productive resources of society, from the mines to the printing presses to the factories, the Gene Reinhardts, Twiggy Forrest, Jeff Bezoses, all those people in the world. They're not a group of people that are going to allow their power to be progressively reformed out of existence. I think, actually, on the whole, democratic socialists accept the pervasive notion in society that parliament is at the centre of decision-making. It's a very common-sense idea. You'll find it in any high school politics textbook. But it's totally wrong, I think. Because whoever sits in parliament, real economic power in society, real decision-making, sits with the capitalist class, the people who make all the major decisions over the functioning of the economy, who sit on the boards of the major corporations, all that kind of stuff. And it's the capitalist class's control over production and investment that's their first line of defence against democratically elected governments that want to get in their way and try and overturn their rule. So time after time through history, reformist governments that have tried to undermine the interests of the capitalist class have faced serious resistance from the capitalist class. From Swedish social democracy in the 1970s to the Mitterrand socialist government in France in the 80s to more recently Syriza in Greece just in 2015. The capitalist class, by virtue of the fact that they control the economy, can organise investment strikes, move their wealth out of the country and hoard goods to create panics and shortages to undermine these governments. So I think it means that socialism can't be achieved just through gradual successive victories of the working class, piling reform on top of reform until you reach a socialist society. So when modern democratic socialists talk about a strategy to erode the structural power of capital, really what they're echoing is a very old idea going back to people like Karl Kautsky in the early 20th century, who talked about a war of attrition against the capitalist system to slowly and gradually demoralise the capitalist class and undermine their power. In reality, though, I don't think capitalism works like that at all. Class struggle under capitalism is a dynamic back-and-forth struggle. So for long periods, like the period that we're just coming out of right now, workers feel like they can't challenge the power of their bosses. Levels of class struggle are low, conservative ideas tend to predominate, and people who are militants and radicals are singled out and isolated. Then, generally the pattern in history is that struggle starts to break out in massive waves and draws millions of people in behind it. You can see this in Australian history, I think. So actually, many of the greatest victories of the working class in Australia were won in a very short period, from basically around 1968, 1969 through the mid-1970s. So in that time, workers smashed anti-union laws and opened the floodgates to all sorts of things, from universal healthcare to equal pay for women, and strikes played a key role in winning things like land rights and ending the Vietnam War. In Australia, across that period, pay for workers went up on average by about 30%. So these are like sorts of victories that are just unimaginable to working class people in Australia today. But the 70s also shows that the capitalist class won't allow these victories to just accumulate for too long, and they'll always find ways to fight back and undermine those victories. So the whole story of the last 40 years has been the rolling back of a lot of the gains that were won through the last radical period of the 60s, 70s and 80s. So I think a realistic socialist strategy has to take into account the fact that working class struggle doesn't just come incrementally like a linear line on a graph, but tends to come in big waves and kind of discontinuous upsurges. And so social strategy has to take into account that and be prepared basically to decisively confront capitalist institutions when we actually have the strength on our side. I think most importantly, though, and this is the key argument, actually, is that the capitalist state can't be used to create socialism. For a lot of these democratic socialists today, the strength and power of the capitalist state is their key argument against the politics of workers' revolution. And there's a contradiction there, I think. So Vivek Chibba puts it like this. He says, "Today the state has infinitely greater legitimacy with the population than states did a century ago. Further, its coercive power, its power of surveillance, and the ruling class's internal cohesiveness gives the social order a stability that is orders of magnitude greater than it had in 1917. So obviously he's referring there to the Russian Revolution. There's a contradiction here, which is that the state is too omnipotent, too powerful to be overthrown through working class revolution, but can supposedly be peacefully and gradually transformed into a socialist institution from within. I think this is utopian because the state isn't a neutral democratic instrument. It's designed from top to bottom to preserve capitalist society. So the state isn't just the elected government, it's a whole bunch of different branches and a vast organisation. from the police, the army, the judiciary, the civil service, and all these institutions have a top-down command structure, just like capitalist enterprises. The figures that run them aren't democratically elected and accountable, and by virtue of their jobs, they're members of the ruling class. So any party in parliament, that small bit of the state that is elected, that wants to challenge the interests of the capitalist class, first faces the prospect of passive and active resistance from all of these institutions, the bureaucracies that implement policy, the civil service. But if it goes further than that and actually tries to seriously challenge capitalism, it also faces repression from the whole repressive apparatus of the state, so the police and the army. Parliament is itself as an institution, clearly there are a bunch of democratic rights in there that socialists wish to uphold and defend to the extent that they're useful for us. But it's worth saying that it's also a form of democracy that's fundamentally inadequate, I think, for the tasks of transforming society and creating socialism. There's a study in the UK a few years ago that found that the average amount of time that a citizen in the UK spends participating in the democratic process over their lifetime is about 20 minutes. So all the questions and debates about strategy, about objectives, about principles that need to go on for workers to create a social society, Parliament just doesn't offer an avenue to do that when at best it's 20 minutes of your life standing, feeling pretty isolated in front of a ballot box. So I think these realities about just how the system works, you know, the irreformable nature of the capitalist system, the hostility of the capitalist state to social change that we're looking for, point to the need for precisely such a ruptural approach to the system of capitalism that the democratic socialists rule out of order, utopian, unreasonable. And I think this isn't just theoretical speculation either. I kind of mentioned before the democratic socialist strategy is far from new. And I think history over the last century has proved in spades, often through quite painful lessons, the impossibility of a parliamentary road to socialism. And so one example that I wanted to talk about was the example of Chile in the 1970s. This was when Salvador Allende, who was the leader of a coalition of left parties called Popular Unity, was elected president. And the reason I want to talk about this experience is I think that it shows that under the best possible conditions for a democratic socialist strategy, any socialist strategy that rejects a rupture with the capitalist class is a dead end and can't win. So Chile was the perfect case test case for a parliamentary road to socialism. It was a country with a long, stable parliamentary tradition dating way back to the 1830s. And as democratic socialists will point out when they talk about Chile, many workers initially looked to elections within the existing capitalist state as a means to improve their lives and change society. Allende's election as well didn't come off the back of just a passive election campaign like the sorts of ones every 3 years that we're used to in Australia. There were more than 15,000 grassroots election committees staffed by workers, peasants and oppressed people that organised all over Chile to try and help get Allende elected. So the first year of Allende's presidency, he was elected in 1970, at first glance I think seemed to vindicate the promise of a peaceful road to socialism. Or at least that workers could make significant gains with a party in government. So wages rose by 30%, prefabricated houses were made to be given out to the poor to provide them housing often for the first time, every school child got a pint of milk a day. And it wasn't just in the kind of legislative arena as well that things were going forward. The election of the government gave confidence to workers, to peasants, to oppressed people to start fighting. So in the first year alone, 530 businesses were taken over by their workers and subjected to collectivisation. But a more fundamental kind of confrontation, I think, was inevitable in this situation, because when they're reforming governments in power, it's precisely these successes in raising working class living standards that mean that the capitalist class are going to respond. They never take the erosion of their power and their profits lying down. So very quickly, the capitalist class started to organise. They locked thousands of workers out of their jobs, small businesses engaged in hoarding, and capitalists and small business owners in the transport industry organised two huge bosses' strikes to basically shut down the economy and cripple it. So in times like this, this is when democratic socialists argue that you need the movements outside of the state. This, for them, workers outside of the state can rally in defence of the elected government, fight back against capital sabotage, and hold the government to account and make sure they stick, you know, true to the path of gradually transitioning towards socialism. But what happened in Chile, it's true that the working class didn't take this stuff lying down, they fought. But instead of the working class movement on the streets and the socialists in government working in tandem, instead what happened was there is kind of an increasing divergence between the two forces. So even at its most radical, a democratic socialist strategy hinges on the idea that maintaining harmony with the undemocratic capitalist state and with private business is a precondition for achieving any positive change. So Yende's main priority when things started to heat up was to restore a sense of stability. So as one of his allies in the coalition government explained, he said, "Our task right now is to prevent our enemies from being provoked." They described their strategy as one of national coexistence, i.e. coexistence with the capitalist class. Allende increasingly carried out this strategy. So a lot of those workers I mentioned before that took over their factories and collectivised them, Allende handed the factories back to their owners to avoid a confrontation. When the working class made demands that, you know, kept going beyond Allende's compromise position, the government began to see not just the capitalist class that were organising against them, but also the mobilised working class from below as a threat to their kind of project and their strategy of winning socialism through consensus. So then key sections of the state started to move against the Allende government: the military, the courts, and the civil service. At the beginning of his term, Allende had signed this document, it's kind of legendary now, I guess, in the history of the socialist movement in Chile, called the Statute of Guarantees. What it was basically a pledge to the ruling class in Chile that all these institutions, the military, the police, the courts, that the government would not interfere with the functioning of any of these institutions, would not try to confront them, would not even try to change who staffed them, essentially, as a sign of goodwill. But Allende, now that things started to heat up, moved even further, placing three of the hostile army generals that were starting to organise against the government into his cabinet as a sign of goodwill. The response of the working class, though, was very different, I think, because the working class don't have to be constrained either by respect for the capitalist class, you know, their right to rule, or the sanctity of the institutions that they use to run society. So by 1972, workers had begun to develop organisations that brought into question the normal functioning of government and who was going to run society. So in response to the capitalist hoarding that I mentioned before, workers formed institutions called juntas, or committees, which were democratic, worker-organised bodies to control the distribution of goods. They challenged the sabotage and the speculation of the capitalist class. So essentially, storehouses full of food that was being held and taken off the market to create a sense of crisis, they would break in, take all of the produce, and then divide it up amongst the working class democratically. In the factories, the goods, instead of going to the market to be sold, went directly to these committees, which would then organise the kind of distribution of the commodities that were produced in the factories. A lot of the small shops and supermarkets owned by right-wingers who closed during the bosses' strikes were forcibly reopened by the working class, again, in a democratic fashion. And in the factories, seeing the need to organise against the sabotage of the bosses, workers in the industrial centres formed institutions called cordones, which were essentially factory councils. So whole sections of industry were taken under workers' control and formed a network of basically grassroots democratic institutions that started to resemble the embryo of a socialist state. And these institutions basically could do what the government was failing to do, which was to decisively confront the capitalist class and push forward with their agenda. Even in, you know, that most undemocratic, brutal and hierarchical capitalist institution, the army, soldiers began to start to organise mutinies and working class democracy in the army to undermine the threats of the generals who wanted a coup. So the sense in Chile by 1973 that a final confrontation was coming was pretty palpable. In June of that year, there was an abortive, basically trial run of a coup led by a lieutenant colonel who was trained and supported by the Americans. And the working class all over the country started demanding to the main political parties, like Allende Socialist Party and the Communist Party, that they arm them. Instead, what those parties did is use the generals that were placed in their government to sweep the factories and the streets and collect up all the arms to disarm the working class and basically undermine the possibility of resistance when it came down to the crunch. And so when the military coup finally came that everyone saw was coming on September 11, 1973... and installed a brutal dictatorship, the working class were disarmed and left without any kind of political leadership that could show an alternative road. And the ensuing reactionary violence that came out of this situation left 30,000 people dead. It was one of, the most brutal defeats for the working class movement in its history. We should take this violence, I think, as evidence of the lengths that the capitalist class will go to maintain their social system when it's under threat. And it was made worse by the role that the democratic socialists in government played in refusing to countenance the necessity of that kind of confrontation. So one of Allende's colleagues, actually, in the Socialist Party, realised this and said, "The best way of precipitating a confrontation and to make it even more bloody is to turn one's back upon it." So this experience in Chile, I think one of the most important experiences for the working class in the 20th century, imparted a bunch of really important lessons I wanted to go through. The first is, I think, quite obvious here, which is that the ruling class won't respect democratic mandates when their power is threatened. And the more successful a socialist government is at implementing reforms that they don't like, the more likely a decisive confrontation is going to be part of the process. The second is that a capitalist state is a fundamental obstacle to the construction of socialism and needs to be destroyed. So Allende's failure, I don't think we should see it as just a case of individual treachery or a lack of backbone or any of those things. It was a logical consequence of his politics. His political project led him to side with the stability of the capitalist state and business, even when the state wanted him gone. So Allende actually promoted Augusto Pinochet, an army to the commander in chief of the armed forces in Chile, just a month before Pinochet was the individual who actually led the coup that deposed Allende and then, you know, led to the ending of his life and the construction of a military dictatorship in Chile. I think the third and most important lesson, though, is that there was an alternative to the coup and the capitulation that happened in Chile. It was summed up, I think, by the General Secretary of the MIR, which was the largest revolutionary group in Chile, in an underground press conference that they hosted after the coup was kind of finalised. And he said, "The reformist project assumed by popular unity, the coalition, imprisoned itself in the bourgeois order. With the hope of achieving an alliance with a section of the bourgeoisie, it didn't base itself on the revolutionary organisation of the workers, on their own organs of power. It refused an alliance with the soldiers and junior officers. It preferred to try and to fortify itself within the capitalist state apparatus and the officer corps of the armed forces." The working class in Chile, on the other hand, showed a pretty incredible capacity for self-organisation. Initially, this emerged out of just the practical necessities of struggle, the need to maintain the food supply, the need to combat the sabotage that capitalists were organising. But very rapidly, it began to take on more and more of the functions of organising society as a whole. So this was an emerging situation of what socialists refer to as dual power, where the capitalist state was confronted with a whole new complex of institutions based on working class democracy that, you know, promoted a challenge to their rule. To effectively block the resistance from the capitalist class, the bureaucracy and the military, these organisations of popular and working class democracy would have to become, I think, a substitute state. This means breaking fundamentally with the democratic socialist strategy by taking power, workers taking power, against both the repressive wings of the state like the army, but also against a parliamentary socialist in government that didn't want to go that far. And I think it's worth saying as well that it's in the context of a workers' revolution, when capitalism is severely destabilised, that challenging the state becomes a real possibility. There's a quote from the Belgian revolutionary Ernest Mandel, which I think sums this up really well, where he says, "These defences permit no lasting assemblies or sieges of long duration. They can be dismantled, but at precise moments, when a juxtaposition of circumstances momentarily weakens or even paralyses the enemy's ability to make use of them. But this moment never lasts long. It's called a revolutionary crisis." So in response to those democratic socialists that say that the state is simply too powerful to confront, I think it's the reality of workers' revolution, where everything about the running society is up in the air, where the ruling class are paralysed, where they're divided, that, you know, challenging the capitalist state actually becomes a real possibility and not just a far-flung dream that we have. I think the fundamental lesson of Chile is that the contest between two rival states, the state that's based on workers' institutions and the state based on, you know, the capitalist parliament, the military and the bureaucracy, that kind of conflict can only be resolved when, basically, by the destruction of one of those institutions and the other one taking over the rulership of society. And the better organised and clear-sighted revolutionaries are about the need to do that, I think the less violence is actually necessary to achieve that victory. What you got instead in Chile was both defeat and massive violence as a result of the victory of the capitalist class. Unfortunately, though, I think it's worth saying, many democratic socialists at the time drew very different lessons from the experience in Chile. Unwilling to break this kind of countenance, this kind of break with the capitalist state, a lot of them concluded that Allende's government was defeated because it was too radical, because it moved along the path of reform too quickly. Instead, it should have been more slow, methodical, fought harder to maintain consensus with the capitalist class to avoid getting those sections of society offside. I think the conservative logic of this conclusion can only lead in one direction, which is towards the perspective that winning socialism is fundamentally impossible. If at times like these, where the working class are mobilised, where they're organised, where millions of people want socialism, if that's not a time to fight for a break with the system, but instead to seek compromise with the capitalist class, then the fight for socialism just has to be put off indefinitely and we're never going to get it. I think that kind of pessimism and defeatism in some ways is actually echoed by the democratic socialists who write today. So both Vivek Chiba and Bhaskar Sankara, in their manifestos for democratic socialism, they make concessions to this logic. So by writing off the possibility of a revolutionary challenge to capitalism, they end up accommodating with the politics of social democracy and equating a kind of utopian, nicer, more friendly capitalism with socialism. So Bhaskar Sankara's book, The Socialist Manifesto, describes Sweden in the 1970s as socialism. This capitalist country, I think, with a welfare state is and higher wages slightly for some workers, is described by Sankara as the most humane social system ever created. Yet in his book, a few pages later, he concedes that the country in the 1970s was still owned by 15 families and neglects to mention that it was and remains today a monarchy. He also forgets to mention that the country became rich by supplying raw materials to Nazi Germany, by plundering resources to and from and selling weapons to poor countries in the world, ironic given, you know, their adopted stance of neutrality in all of those conflicts. And like all countries that are capitalist, Sweden now is seeing the undermining of a lot of those gains that were won in the 1970s. So Sweden is the country now that has the fastest growing levels of inequality in the developed world. Vivek Chibra, on the other hand, urges us to start out on the road of building social democracy while acknowledging basically the dead end that social democracy has reached. He says, "Social democracy was a spent force by the 1980s. As parties degenerated into a managerial ethos, their reformist agenda was halted and then reversed, and they have proven to be largely uninterested in revitalising their own legacy. For this phenomenon to be so widespread and so pervasive means that it can't have been because of individual failings. There was something structural behind it." He's right that there was something structural behind it, but his own proposals for revitalising social democracy, I think, can't overcome those limitations. They're limitations that are a result of a project of trying to run the capitalist state in a period where the capitalist class write off conceding any reforms and want a more unequal, a more brutal and a more violent system, not a nicer one. So these are dead-end strategies, I think, and I think it would be a tragedy if at this time when thousands, actually millions of people across the world are moving into the socialist movement for the first time, if we lowered our horizons to looking for just a nicer capitalism. I think it's particularly utopian today given actually the direction that the world is headed. It's not like the 1950s and the 1960s where, you know, some sections of the working class were getting wage rises. There was a sense that society was becoming in some ways more rational, more tolerant, more peaceful. Today's society, capitalist society everywhere, is looking more unequal, more brutal, more violent, more irrational. If you look at the impending climate crisis, the ratcheting up imperialist tensions between the United States and China that threaten the first major war in many decades, or the rise of the far right across the world. So at this time, to think that we're going to get governments that administer a nicer capitalism, I think, is a dangerous illusion that we should not, you know, fall prey to and we should resist. I think just thinking about this talk and some of these arguments, I was reminded pretty classically of a quote from Rosa Luxemburg from more than a century ago in her essay Reform or Revolution, which is touching on very similar debates. And it's relevant today, I think, because of the subtitle of this talk, which I think was, I didn't pick it, but it's like Democratic Socialism, an Easier Method of Change. So Luxemburg said, "People who pronounce themselves in favour of the method of legislative reform in place of the conquest of political power and social revolution do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for surface modifications of the old society. Our programme becomes not the realisation of socialism, but the reform of capitalism. Not the suppression of the system of wage labour, but the diminution of exploitation, that is, the suppression of the abuses of capitalism instead of the suppression of capitalism itself." So what Luxemburg was arguing there is that the key divide within the left and the socialist movement, in her time and I think since, is not between two different methods for getting to socialism, you know, a parliamentary road and the road of revolution and violence. It's actually between those who seek to overthrow capitalism and build a society based on totally different structures and totally different logic, and those who seek to manage the system of capitalism in a more humane way. And that's why I think we, Socialist Alternative, our organisation, stand pretty proudly in the tradition of revolutionary socialism. Revolution, I think, and you can only conclude from the history and the experience of working class struggle, is necessary to win socialism. It's necessary, firstly, because the ruling class can't be overthrown in any other way. So the organised working class is the only force that has the power to challenge capitalism. Workers can challenge the capitalist class at the root of their power, which is in production. They can cripple industry through mass strikes and stop the flow of profits. But they can also restart production under their democratic control and build new institutions to create a more democratic state and smash the capitalist state. So revolutionary upheavals in the last century have seen such situations of dual power, often in even more profound and impressive ways than in Chile in 1973. So this happened in Russia in 1917, Finland in 1918, Italy in 1919, Germany and China in the 1920s, Spain in the 1930s, Hungary in the 50s, Portugal and Iran in the 70s, and Bolivia in 2003. There's other examples as well, but time and time again, working class struggle, when it reaches a certain level, shows the massive creative potential that workers have to build new institutions that prefigure a different type of society. The second reason, though, I think it's necessary is because what the process of revolution does to the people that are involved in it. Through mass collective struggle, workers can kind of gain a sense of their own power and shake off all the muck of capitalist ideology and become kind of conscious of the necessity of taking power into their own hands. Working class struggle as well can unite people in solidarity against our exploiters, which means challenging all of the oppressive and divisive ideas that pit us against each other. And so the process of revolution, workers basically taking control of society into their own hands, can shake off all other kinds of muck as well, not just bigoted and backwards ideas, but the sense of powerlessness that we all have every day, that we can't run society. Democratic socialists, I think, even though they talk about mass struggle, they tend to downplay the incredible creative role, potential that workers' struggle has, because they see it as playing basically an auxiliary role. Workers' struggle is there to support socialist government rather than a creative force in its own right. And I hope people go along to some more of the sessions this weekend about different revolutions to discuss and learn about the different examples of the amazing things that happen when workers, you know, turn the world upside down, try to challenge the running of society by the capitalist class. Just to finish, in the last decade, we've seen whole new ways of revolutions sweep the world, beginning in Tunisia and Egypt in 2011, continuing today in places like Algeria and Sudan. More often than not, in these revolutions, the organised working class have actually been in the vanguard of the struggle, have been the key force that have got things going, that have helped people feel the confidence that they can challenge regimes. So to ask whether we think revolutions should happen in the future, I think is kind of missing the point about revolution. Revolutions are going to happen, you know, regardless of what we in this room or socialists anywhere in the world think. It's not socialists who create revolutions, but it's the conditions of capitalism. Capitalism is a barbarous system. It's a system based on the rule of a tiny minority of the population, constantly throws up new forms of crisis and new atrocities that make it necessary and inevitable for people to resist. So revolutions themselves, I think, capitalism has shown, are inevitable. There will be more of them. There'll continue to be revolutions until capitalism is gotten rid of. What's not inevitable, though, is whether revolutions will succeed. And this is the important thing, I think. Whether they'll culminate in workers and the oppressed actually taking power into our own hands and getting us on the road to winning socialism. Because every revolution, like Chile in 1970 to 1973, creates a question of leadership and puts our politics to the test, the politics of people who want to change the world. So it's not surprising today that strategies that look to reforming capitalism are in vogue. The people that are moving towards more left-wing ideas for the first time, I think often, are bound to hold on to many of the kind of more common-sense ideas that prevail in society while they're doing it. That parliament is where you should look to for change, that it's impossible for ordinary people to run society ourselves without the politicians and the experts, and that revolution is an impossible dream that we shouldn't, you know, even bother entertaining. But if we want to win, and we want to win socialism, not just fight, we have to build political organisations, I think, that take the best lessons from the long tradition of socialism and working class struggle. And for the last century, I think it's pretty conclusive. Every democratic socialist party that's tried to win socialism through the state has failed. They've either been overthrown by the capitalist class, or often in many cases worse, have been transformed themselves into a bulwark of capitalist rule, instead administering the system and repressing resistance as it pops up. On the other hand, every working class revolution over the last century has shown the potential to create democratic organs of working class power that have to confront the state or be destroyed by it. So today, there's a lot to talk about today. We're far from a revolution here in Australia, and unfortunately we're far from a revolution in a lot of places in the world. But how you think socialism can be won influences what you do in the here and now. And there's a basic choice, I think, for political organisations that are built around socialist politics. Either you aspire to wield power within the capitalist state, or you choose to promote the self-organisation of the working class from here up to and including the overthrow of the system and workers seizing power. I think the times that we're living through today call people to commit themselves to the latter, to building working class organisation to the point of seizing power. And that's our project today and the project of revolutionary socialists all across the world. And if you think that sounds good, you should get involved with that. Thanks, guys. That was a pretty wild discussion. I'll try to tie some of it together in the just couple of minutes that I have. Well, I guess firstly, just the first question that was raised about what do socialists say about elections and what do we do come election time? I think the starting point for us has to be that there's a difference between socialists paying attention to elections, even intervening into elections, and electoral socialism. They can sound quite similar, but they're very different things. We're not agnostic about elections. Chile is actually an example of an election playing a very important role in social struggle. It was the kind of confidence that came out of nominally socialists being elected to parliament that kick-started a process that could have actually potentially culminated in workers seriously challenging capitalism. And as some other speakers have pointed out, socialist alternative ourselves have had some experiments in trying to figure out how can revolutionaries participate in elections over the last year. Electoral socialism is a very different thing, though, because what that says is that having a majority in parliament and holding on to it is a precondition for any social change. And I fundamentally think that that's wrong. And there's a bunch of different ways you can look at it. Firstly, we know through history that actually mobilised and organised working class, mobilised social movements, struggling oppressed people from below, win more gains under a conservative government than if we have a pro-worker government and passivity on the streets. That's just a basic fact of history. Everything that we've won has that's been regardless of who sits in parliament. It's been depends on the balance of forces and how strong our side is. But more fundamentally, and I think it was kind of the theme of a lot of the discussion, the political strategy that ties you to the idea that you have to hold on to a majority in parliament to change anything ties you to the capital system and the stability of the state. And so people who are committed to that project end up becoming a barrier to social change. The second question was on about reformism. It's a really interesting one. I think it's worth distinguishing between two things, and Elliot, one of the speakers, started to draw it out at the end, between the kind of reformist ideas that most workers have at most normal times, like most workers today in Australia are reformists. They think the society should be better and should be better for workers particularly, and bosses should pay for it, but they're not for overthrowing the system. There's a difference between that and reformist institutions, because what happens when you have people who start politically organising around that worldview is that they build important institutions that are incorporated into the system of capitalism that then become a conservative brake on struggle. So that quote from Rosa Luxemburg I mentioned a bit earlier, a former revolution, Luxemburg didn't just write that pamphlet at the end of the 19th century because it was an interesting thought experiment. Luxemburg wrote that pamphlet because the party that she was a member of, the Social Democrats in Germany, was developing a wing of people who for the first time were openly arguing we should abandon the prospect of overthrowing capitalism and instead seek to peacefully ameliorate conditions and gradually reform things to better situations. That didn't just happen for no reason. That happened because it was a mass party that gradually became incorporated into the German state and into the structures of German capitalism. When you have a party that's committed to peaceful and gradual reform, what do you get? You get a layer of trade union officials who are not workers but exist to negotiate between workers and bosses. You get a group of parliamentarians that want to keep their plush jobs in parliament and don't want to get kicked out by doing anything controversial. You get a whole layer of bureaucrats who are there to maintain membership roles, keep the offices open, but aren't there because of their commitment to overthrowing capitalism. So the German SPD, actually, the Social Democrats there, they're kind of the classic example, because that divide between the revolutionaries in that party, like Luxemburg, who wanted to overthrow capitalism, and the people that wanted to manage it, became such an irreconcilable divide that they literally ended up in a civil war against each other, two wings of the working movement. The communists and the revolutionaries who tried to build working class self-organisation to overthrow capitalism, and the social democrats who ended up running the state themselves, who crushed them and will eventually, to the extent of killing, quite a large number of them. That's obviously not the situation that we're in today, but the divide still matters. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, I think the person who spoke at the front raised a really good point, which is that bullshitting about how we're going to win socialism doesn't help us to get closer to it. And it's one of the problems, I think, with the air of kind of good times and optimism around Sanders and Corbyn. There are positive things that these phenomena say about our political situation. But saying that they are opening up a situation where we can win socialism is preparing people for massive demoralisation and defeat. And the higher the stakes, I think, the bigger the demoralisation and defeat. So one of the really important examples from very recent history is the Syriza government in Greece, which I don't have time to talk about today, but people should learn about it, read about it, study it if they're interested in these questions. It was a government, an anti-austerity government in Greece that was elected just a few years ago, which because of, again, its commitment to the stability of the system, managing the state and compromising with the bosses, sold out not just the anti-austerity movement and the aspirations of the working class in Greece, but the aspirations of the whole European working class. That didn't just fail to advance things further, but it set the workers' movement back across that entire continent massively. So revolutionaries, us, the people who know that those strategies are not actually going to deliver what we want, we can't get anywhere by bullshitting about that, and we have to be serious about building our political organisation in the here and now. We've got a long way to go here, but we're armed with some of the best ideas and lessons from history, and that's a positive, so we might as well get cracking now.